This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here in New York in our studio with our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And our digital director, Mike Hogan.
You're actually here.
I love being
here. It's so
exciting. It feels so cozy to be in this room with all the padding around us. But on the line, as always, Joanna Robinson, we miss you here. You are here with us in our hearts.
Not here is Joanna Robinson. Hi, guys.
Not here.
Representing the West Coast and the Heartland, as always. Joanna, come back to New York soon. It's great here. You'll love it. So we're recording this on Wednesday, when kind of in the maelstrom after the midterm elections. I'm very tired. I think Mike is as well. I don't know if Richard and Joanna had more responsible sleep habits.
I had to stay up late to watch Scott Walker lose, and I'm so happy I did.
It's true. That is a really good feeling.
I hate that guy.
So we don't want to talk too much about the midterms, because obviously there are many more well-versed political people to talk about it. But the impact that they might have on the Oscar race, I think, is interesting coming off of a very political award season that we had last year. We're also going to talk a little bit about Netflix's plan to release Roma in theaters and what that is going to look like for them, and then take another look at Bohemian Rhapsody, I think, which we discussed and none of us had seen except Hilary Busis, who kind of weighed in on it, and then it became a huge hit. And then the back half of this episode, Cam Collins is going to be back to share an interview he did with Bing Liu, the director of Minding the Gap, the documentary that's on Hulu now, and we'll talk a little bit more about that film later on. So politics. Mike, you were up late watching the news, just like the rest of us.
Yeah.
I feel like you have been the one of us who's most willing to think about how politics affects these awards people in Hollywood and how much they're thinking about themselves and Trump and everything else. So after all of this, after this kind of valve has been released, like you were saying before we recorded, to get some of this like liberal energy out, what are we going to see on award shows from all these people now?
And I apologize in advance to the people who don't like to hear about politics. But I do think the Oscars are very political. It's
very
inherently political. Hollywood has been going through an incredibly political moment. And unquestionably, the election of Trump, to the horror of sort of liberal America, certainly played a part in, you know, the whole Me Too movement and Time's Up and all of that, right? I think what's happened with Trump is a lot of people on the progressive side of the equation have one after another looked at things that they thought were completely settled and realized that for a lot more Americans than they ever imagined, they were not settled. And also that things that they were kind of in denial about, they needed to confront, I guess.
Or things that they felt like they didn't have to talk about, they suddenly said, okay, it's time to talk about this at the Golden Globe.
Right. I mean, if you think about what Me Too was, it was a lot of people just sharing an experience that they thought was a lot more unique than it turned out to be when suddenly there was this gigantic flood. I mean, I think that was an awakening for a lot of people. So to the extent that there is a healthy silver lining of this strange period of time that we're going through. I think it's people sort of like coming to terms with issues in the world and then taking a constructive approach in many cases. There's lots of whining and rending of garments, but there's also a lot of organizing. People have gotten into politics. So many people that I know have said, like, I was phone banking. I was, you know, out there like helping people. And so that's really interesting. But yes, now that there's been this one achievement in for Democrats, for progressives in taking back the House, I do suspect, and after a full year of Me Too and all the rest of it, I imagine that the temperature is going to be cooler on a lot of these things. There's going to be less of a kind of frantic need to make everything overtly political. Mm-hmm. We'd probably go back a little bit to the old version where it's all, you know, bubbling under the surface
ACLU
a bit more.
Ribbons and like, yeah, veiled comments and an acceptance speech.
But of course, I can't resist looking at the, you know, list of possible Best Picture nominees and winners and thinking about how they line up along these lines, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, you've got A Star is Born is sort of the kind of purple choice in a way. I mean, it's probably the progressives' idea of a purple choice because on the one hand, it's like alt-country, and on the other hand, it's Lady Gaga in a drag bar.
It's the LGBT movie this year, I would say. So no, there's the favorite too, but
can you ever forgive me?
I mean, it's got, in other words, it kind of plays to both sides. You know, there's an argument to be made that Bradley Cooper is at least like an Austin, Texas type of a guy, if not, you know, a blue dot guy.
He probably voted for Beto.
There's a red state thing going on there somewhere. Roma is really, you know, if a lot of people watch it, I think that they'll find it's an incredibly kind of political statement at the end of the day, insisting on the humanity of somebody who is just generally speaking very marginalized. Green Book, you know, there's some, we've talked about it. There's this kind of like concern that it's got some Driving Miss Daisy type reactionary politics while on the face of it being a pro, let's all get along, you know, better movie.
That is what Driving Miss Daisy is about too, right? I haven't seen that movie in a while.
Yeah, and I shouldn't say, I mean, right, that's the Driving Miss Daisy conundrum is like, for, you know, and then you've got, you know, speaking of somebody who likes to criticize Driving Miss Daisy, you've got Spike Lee in there with Black Klansman, a movie that is outwardly saying something that a lot of people are realizing right now, which is that we need to take right-wing white nationalist terrorism a lot more seriously from a law enforcement. I mean, that's what the movie is.
Yeah.
And, you know, you read articles now where people are like, oh, maybe the FBI should be like looking at this stuff. It's like, go watch Spike's movie. So, and you go on to, I mean, Black Panther obviously has a kind of populist sort of progressive, you know, celebration aspect to it. First Man has been the subject of a lot of weird political battles with the New Yorker slamming it as reactionary. A lot of people on the right, you know, complaining that they don't see the flag get driven into the...
Marco Rubio so, weighed in.
I certainly don't think we're like out of the woods here in terms of the Oscars being massively politicized and everybody, if nothing else, it's so tempting for people attached to each film to use that as a lever, right? When you're going down the wire and you've got a competitor, you know, that's so much the subject of the whisper campaigns is like, well, you know, it's got some issues.
Or, you know, I want to vote for Roma because I want to prove that I think Mexicans are people, which is what the president does not want to believe.
And then you have to kind of worry about that Bradley effect that people were talking about last night with some of the races in Florida and Georgia, where people say, oh, I'll vote for the kind of like politically correct thing. And then behind closed doors, they're like, actually, I'm going to vote for, you know, the thing I really like. But I didn't want anyone to know that I'm latently racist or whatever.
Wait, you said Bradley effect, and I thought you meant Bradley Cooper. That's not what you mean.
It's the thing in California election a long time ago, right?
The Bradley effect, yeah, it's based on a candidate, I think his name was Tom Bradley, and he was running and leading in the polls, similar to what we saw with Andrew Gillum last night. People get a call from the pollsters, and they're like, yeah, sure, I think he's great. And then in the privacy of the polling booth, they may be more racist than they want to let on.
Right.
And I think we're all familiar with that phenomenon with the Academy from time to time, especially with a lot of sort of virtue signaling ostensible progressives.
Right.
So there is a lot to discuss. And I think the last thing to think about with politics and the Oscars this year is like, can Hollywood compete on an entertainment value level with Donald Trump, this crazy sort of vampire squid P.T. Barnum world wrestling reality TV you know, carnival barker.
Who wants nothing more than all the attention that you're giving to anything else.
Yeah. I mean, that's what he lives for and spends all of his day thinking about and you know, using the biggest megaphone in the world to get. So that's always sort of there, too. Like, do the Oscars even matter when Trump is doing the craziest pro wrestling reality show from the White House all day, every day? On Twitter and Fox News.
I mean, I think about that all the time, how he's really successfully, and I hate to use the word successfully, turned the presidency into like the number one show in the world. You know, like we talk about the monoculture and like there'll never be a hit like Game of Thrones again, but like this is it. This is what everyone's watching every single day is the Trump show. And I don't know, it's impossible to unplug. It's unconscionable to unplug. You kind of want to look away. But I think that's an excellent question, Mike, is like how does the Academy, how does the movie industry as a whole command the attention when someone else is sucking so much air in the room?
And I think the initial answer to that was by being hashtag resistance.
Yeah, by talking to Trump through the award shows.
And so maybe they'll continue that and maybe not. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think obviously politicians are trying to figure this out, too. So I don't know. I mean, Hollywood has to sort of feel its way through all of this. But I do think it's interesting. And I don't want to be imbalanced in case we have some conservative listeners. I think the issue is just that when we're talking about Hollywood, we're talking about a world that is 85%, I think, on the progressive side of the ledger.
Or if they are not, feel like they need to go along with the general mindset, which is what you hear from.
Hence the Bradley effect.
Yeah.
Lest they be lumped in with James Woods and have to make movies with Kirk Cameron.
Fate worse than death.
Where do you think that Vice could fit into all that, since that's like still a great unknown in this race for a lot of us and is like the most nakedly political Oscar contender in theory, right?
Right. Yeah. I think it could very well. I think it could do really well if it's kind of like the Pod Save America of you know, of this Oscar season, and it becomes a rallying point. I don't know if people actually care about Dick Cheney now or not. Is the one sort of weird question I have.
Well, it's a matter of tone. We don't really know what the tone of that movie is. My guess is that it's not something that's going to try to humanize him too much, that it's like going to be like a dark story about how this guy did all these dark things. And in that case, like, you know, if we are riding a little high right now, we, you know, on the left or whatever, maybe we're okay with that. You know, maybe we're okay with a little Cheney because, like, we feel a little bit triumphant right now. I think that if Tuesday had gone another direction, I don't think there would be any appetite for a movie like that.
Mm.
That's interesting.
And it makes me curious, too, just in terms of you think about last year and about, you know, it was the second Oscars in the Trump era. But it really feels like, you know, it was the first full year of all that. And The Shape of Water ended up winning, which was a kind of, I mean, not apolitical exactly, but sort of a cozy, romantic, nice choice. And maybe it was because people were, you know, feeling beaten down and scared and just wanted to go for something romantic and that made them feel good. And now if we, again, have a little momentum behind us, do we say, yeah, Black Panther wins or Black Klansman wins or, you know, something else that feels more, like you said, you know, like Roma is political in a sense. So,
or is it A Star Is Born, which is a huge hit, kind of cozy and apolitical in its way, too.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I feel like Shape of Water also had this narrative around it of like this is a story about inclusivity. Like the fish monster is a metaphor for all the people who are marginalized by the, you know, because there's all that.
Like, Yamato Toro said that in interviews, I think.
Weird stuff about the KGB and like all of that.
Honor the fish, honor the film.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and Guillermo being Mexican had sort of inherently political thing there too.
Someone from like, you know, from another side who can be otherized by people. I mean, it definitely he leaned into that metaphor.
But I think Richard, you're right. Like, it was fairly apolitical, you know, compared to even Moonlight
or Get Out,
or The Post,
probably as close as
certainly
Post.
Get Out.
Yeah,
but actually, I mean, A Star Is Born is like really apolitical if you think about it. You know that, and I wonder if that's an issue for A Star Is Born at the end of the day. Like, we all went nuts for it critically in the kind of like, wow, this is a guilty pleasure that I actually love. And it has been a hit, but it kept losing to Venom, right? I mean, I don't know if that matters or not. Like, I don't know how much money it has to make to
be a true monster
hit. If its narrative was going to be, wow, this is a critically acclaimed, massive blockbuster hit, did it actually achieve the second part of that to the level that that's a kind of like best picture winning momentum? Or does that leave an opening for somebody else to come in?
I just want to clarify to our listeners, at the end of Star Is Born, after the credits, there's a scene where Jackson Maine battles Venom.
Oh, yeah.
And loses.
Oh, bummer.
And then Freddie Mercury comes in.
Yeah, with his big teeth.
I mean, A Star is Born has made $166 million at this point. It's just about to pass Hotel Transylvania 3 in the box office, and then after that, Crazy Rich Asians. So it's, I mean, it's still pretty huge. It does seem like if there's going to be like a movie that will bring us together, which I don't know, like if that was what the national mood is, but I do think that's kind of a unifying force, maybe even more so than Black Panther, even though Black Panther is a much bigger hit.
I mean, it felt biggish, but it also felt, once again, it feels early.
Yeah, like peaking too early in the Oscars.
Yeah, an early peak, not as leggy as maybe we would hope. You know, and what's interesting is, like, we don't know what we know until these things hit the mainstream. And so, like, I think we're today reassessing our Bohemian Rhapsody, like, feelings because of the way in which the mainstream has reacted to it. And so, like, once again, these other things that have yet to open wide, we don't know what we don't know yet.
Yeah, Vice comes out and makes $85 million.
Yeah, then yeah. We say the Dick Cheney revival is mm-hmm. upon us. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I just feel like on a basic level, like, it's hard for me to imagine something like Meryl Streep at the Golden Globes yelling about Trump in, I guess, January 2017, like right before the inauguration. He feuded with her on Twitter. Like, remember how that's how he started his presidency?
Can I say one more thing about that? I think a lot of people are wising up to what feeds Trump and helps him and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And going up against him in that way and kind of spouting your outrage in a way that enables, gives him the opportunity to hit back, I think a lot of people have decided they don't want to play that game mm-hmm. anymore, including
yeah.
probably a lot of celebrities, if yeah. I had to guess. There was a time to say, let's make it very clear that we're against this. And then it feels like there's now kind of a time to say, if this 2-year-old wants to keep having a tantrum, the rest of us can go on.
We can go operate on another
level. That feels to me like
we can go knock on doors and get progressive candidates in things and
yes.
win.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so I feel like, yeah, maybe the pointedness won't be there in such a way, but like the Academy will just go and, you know, either nominate or award. You know, movies that feel like that same momentum, mm-hmm. you know.
Plus, you don't want to like fall into unintentionally into the Oprah trap and like be accused of running for president just because you give a rousing speech at an awards ceremony.
Yes.
Oh, God. By the time awards season happens, we'll have like 10 declared Democratic candidates all running. It'll be too crowded to make your way in there.
Also, don't be surprised if people in Hollywood are just say, oh, great, everything's fixed now, and get super complacent.
Oh,
and forward. Green Book wins.
I mean, I'm not, I'm telling you, I don't be shocked.
Yeah. Oh, man, we got a long way to go still. So let's talk about Bohemian Rhapsody, Joanna, since you brought it up. We talked last week about Best Actor, and I think both of us, we definitely mentioned Rami Malek, but I think we were both a little bit iffy on his chances of breaking into Best Actor, even though his performance has been so praised as part of this movie that it has somewhat a mixed critical reception. And there's been the kind of the hoary meme going around being like, oh, it's a critic-proof movie. It's proof that critics don't get it, which I take objection to. But, I mean, we do have to consider Bohemian Rhapsody way more than we did 2 weeks ago, right?
I would say absolutely. I mean, like, I think, you know, something that we should have paid more attention to maybe is the idea that, like, even people who were really down on the movie, as you say, Katie, were really high on Rami. And, like, when he won the Emmy for Mr. Robot, that was also a time when that show was not as high as it had been when it first premiered. Just that, like, Rami Malek's win and Rami Malek's career in general, I think, has just been, like, a tremendous amount of goodwill for him as a performer, despite maybe the whatever's happening around him, because he is just, like, a very magnetic performer. And, you know, and then when you have a large swath of audience, because, like, you know, from my man on the street perspective, not only do I know a lot of people who saw it opening weekend, but I expected them to go see it and then come back and be like, oh, I wish I hadn't. They were all like, it was pretty good. I liked it. All the behind the scenes machinations that we discussed a couple weeks ago on this podcast, they have no idea about it. So they were just like, you know, when I pointed out, I was like, well, didn't you think it was a little bit much like the other Queen members were taking credit? They're like, oh, yeah, I see it now that you pointed out, but it didn't really land with me when I watched
this
it.
Movie for these
yeah.
people,
I don't know. Anyway, I'm glad people enjoyed the Queen movie. And I mean, like, it was a really canny movie, as I suspect, like, the Elton John movie that's coming out, I think next year will be, is like, this is such built-in advertisement. When you are a studio and you're looking for intellectual property, when you're looking for, you know, like a franchise or a book adaptation or whatever people are familiar with, like, when you can release a trailer that's just like wall-to-wall Queen hits and people are like, well, I want to go watch wall-to-wall Queen hits on the big screen. Like, that's what people are there for. You know, this is like kind of the ultimate jukebox musical as as disguised as a biopic.
And it's funny, with as I was watching the success of it after our conversation, I'm thinking to myself, why did we bet against the guys from Queen who turned their kind of like perfectly good rock music into a giant international, you know, like popular money printing thing? I've got to give credit to Brian Hyatt, who's a really smart writer at Rolling Stone, who had this good tweet the other day. He said, I dare someone to write the success of Greta Van Fleet. Are you guys familiar with Greta Van Fleet, the new rock band that got a 0.0, I think, review on Pitchfork and is like huge now? The success of Greta Van Fleet and Bohemian Rhapsody suggests a powerful unmet hunger for rock music out there.
Oh,
boy. You know, he's ready for someone to write that think piece. But people are ready. They want some rock. They want to rock.
Sure.
This is all part of my theory that we're going into the millennial 70s. we're in the millennial 70s. We're going to
so gas prices are going to go up.
That's what A Star Is Born is, in theory, right? You know?
That's true.
Ish.
Yes.
The thing I'm curious about with Bohemian Rhapsody, in kind of a grim way, is here we have a $50 million opening for a director who is mired in, you know, potential scandal. There's rumor of an Esquire article looming.
There have been other articles and reports about alleged behavior that is enough real scandal.
I've heard things about the Esquire article that, like, it's if they're able to publish the stuff, it's like career ending. But right now, that's not out yet. And so, you know, are we just going to go full steam ahead with Bryan Singer? I mean, he's got Red Sonja, I guess, now with the same studio. It's just an interesting sort of thing to watch because, like, he got fired off the movie. We're like, okay, this is the beginning of the end. And then the movie comes, and then it got bad reviews, and we're like, okay. But then it's a huge hit, so.
Yeah, he got fired off the movie in the middle of Me Too. Like, it was sometime last fall. But it was like, oh, he should have played to set all the time. Like, he was not fired for any, like, personal behavior issues, which was a weird, fascinating wrinkle. But it did kind of feel like, all right, fine. He got Me Too'd. He's done for.
Right.
And I just can't think of another recent example of someone like Rami Malek now feels like he has a decent shot at a Best Actor nomination.
Yeah.
And will be doing a full, like, months and months of Oscar campaign for a movie directed by a director who we, like, I think he's admitted that they've feuded on set. Like,
well, that was part of the major report. I feel like Rami Malek coming to, like, not literal blows. Bryan Singer, like, threw something not at Rami Malek when they were fighting on set. That's in the THR, like, expose about it. But, like, that was what I think finally stopped Bryan Singer, is, like, Rami Malek being like, he goes or I go.
Yeah, didn't he, like, call the studio and was like, get him out of here?
But what's interesting to me is, like, I guess I didn't fully realize that Bryan Singer, because of a quirk of the DGA, like, it gets full director credit on this. Dexter Fletcher, who finished the film, doesn't. So if Bohemian Rhapsody were in conversation in, like, some of the other categories, not lead actor, then I like, you know, is Bryan Singer going to walk home with an award this season? Like, that
still feels a little far off.
Talking about Rami Malek instead of talking about the movie itself is what we might wind up doing. Because then Rami Malek gets brownie points, and I don't mean that condescendingly. For pushing Bryan Singer off this project, standing
it's like
up for
his
himself.
The Revenant, like, it's his sleeping in a buffalo carcass is getting his director fired.
Right, I don't know.
So, Joanna, you saw Bohemian Rhapsody.
I did, yes.
Okay, and the rest of us are still waiting our turn, huh?
Some plane somewhere, maybe. I'm so biased against music biopics that I just, you know, I just don't care.
I think Rami Malek is better than I expected in it. I still think the film, I still largely agree with Hillary's assessment of it on the podcast a couple weeks ago. I see why it's popular. And I think, you know, Rami Malek is good in it as he is good in everything. That best actor category specifically that we talked about last week, Katie, should definitely include him going forward.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so let's wrap up our conversation part of the episode before we get to Cam's interview. I just wanted to point to an article that Nicole Sperling wrote for us last week about Netflix basically finally deciding what it wants to do with Roma. It's going to be releasing kind of these three Oscar contenders, Roma, and then the Coen Brothers movie Ballad Buster Scruggs, which comes out this week as we record, and then Bird Box with Sandra Bullock. And they'll come out several weeks before they actually go onto Netflix. So Roma's going to be out for a full 3 weeks before it goes to Netflix, which for any other platform is totally sensible. Amazon has movies in theaters for months and months. Months and months before they go into Amazon. But for Netflix, this is kind of a reversal. Like, they said they'd never do it. They came to blows with Cannes over it. Do we think it'll make a difference how most people watch it, and then also how they'll consider it in the Oscar race? I think that's kind of two separate questions.
I think it'll make a difference for film fans who are lucky enough to live in Los Angeles, New York, or Mexico City, where they'll be able to see it in
those
theaters.
Those are literally the only three cities, right?
I think
right?
so. Yeah, I think those are the only three getting the early release.
I've always thought this was good marketing for Netflix, and did not understand why they wouldn't do it.
To release it so early in theaters?
I mean, if everything is marketing at some level, and so movies have like run all these ads on TV in the weeks before they open, and also having movies up on a marquee, even if you kind of say to yourself, like, oh, I should see that, I'm interested, and you don't actually go, like then when you see it pop up on Netflix, you're like, oh, I should watch this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know to what extent that actually matters to Netflix's business model, but I think that's one of the things that kind of is annoying to directors. And then also directors would ideally like to have people watch it. I definitely think it'll help with the Academy. I think the Academy will like this.
Yeah. It's making the concession that gets the deal done or whatever, gets the bill passed, you know? I also think, I mean, I don't know, again, it's just three cities, but like, and one of them doesn't celebrate this holiday, but like, it's opening over Thanksgiving, you know? And so maybe that's the alternative to the artsy family that doesn't want to see Green Book or the family that has loved Cuarón's past movies and was like, well, we got to go see that new thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that moves the needle any at all, but I feel better about the movie's chances knowing that it's going to get something that looks a little bit like a regular release.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also wonder about how it feels if you're Paul Greengrass or Tamara Jenkins or Nicole Holofcson or one of the other filmmakers who's had a film on Netflix this fall that didn't get that. Or even the Coen brothers who's, you know, Buster Scruggs is going to come out a week before instead of 3 weeks before. Like that, the way that it's kind of like saying, okay, this is our real one, and then the rest of these are going to go on Netflix. Don't you think that would be annoying?
Yeah. I mean, and I saw Matt Bellany tweeting a THR column today, basically saying like, now everyone's going to ask for this. And that's going to cost.
Yeah, if you
Netflix
give a mouse a cookie, if you give
problems.
Alfonso Cuarón a release.
I genuinely do not understand why they have been so stubborn on this topic. It seems like a weird kind of Silicon Valley, like
it's like a dumb billionaire gave a chicken, right? It's like, I said, yeah, I'd never do it, so I'm not going
to
do it.
It just feels to me like a principle instead of a thought through policy that's actually based on like reality. But maybe I'm too dumb to get why it's the totally right way to do this.
Well, we don't see their money, so who knows? Yeah.
It's like my thing about how I never favorite tweets. And all like, and then it became the thing like, why? And I was like, I don't really know anymore. But I just keep not favoriting tweets and, you know, being rude to people.
Oh, that makes me feel so much better now that I know that.
I never do it on principle. I never do. It's exactly that, Mike, because there have been not every movie. Plenty of movies can just live on Netflix and do very well, as we saw with some of their more original titles, like, you know, this summer, like To All the Boys I Loved Before. When you have a Cuarón movie, like, you get goodwill from the industry. People are still going to see it. And even if it's just out in three cities, that's going to build word of mouth. And then people will watch it on your service. Like, it just makes complete sense.
Your prestige audience is people who really care about cinema and like check on and see what's playing at their local cool theater. And, you know, it's different from the audience for like a teen romance or something like that. You know, I mean, so why wouldn't you just do... I don't know. I just don't get why they haven't played the game. I'm happy that they're starting to.
I mean, if they win Best Picture with Roma, you can guarantee they'll do it again. Like that's going to be the interesting thing to watch.
One would think.
Yeah.
And again, I know we've talked about this already, but Roma literally opens with like, what is it, 7 minutes? There's like a 7 minute credit sequence of somebody mopping a floor.
Yeah.
You know, like, good luck. If the
intro button shows up on that, I will scream.
I mean, it's just like you've got, you know, you're like sitting there with like a laptop and a phone and multiple pets and people in the other room.
And dishes to do.
You know, it's a nice movie to watch in a theater. Yeah. So I'm glad they're doing it.
For non-Spanish speakers, movies with subtitles are so much better to watch in the theater because you have to look at it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's nowhere else to look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get so stressed out about people skipping certain movies in the theater because I know they're not going to I was really pushing people to see Suspiria in the theater because I know it's not going to land at home just because of that. The like, when a movie like that or Roma takes its time and gets slow and you've got your phone in front of you and you're playing Words with Friends or whatever, like, you know, it's not the same. You can't get lost in it. And so unless people are really disciplined at home and like put their devices away, but I doubt it. So yeah, there are certain movies that I just like push really hard. Roma would be one of them. Suspiria is another. Go to the theater. I understand that's not an easy proposition for a lot of people these days, but do it.
And what's going to happen, like, there's an interesting detail in Nicole's story where they were having negotiations with kind of the big movie exhibitors in Mexico to try to get it, you know, show in the AMC and Regal of Mexico. And they couldn't make a deal because they wouldn't have a 90-day exclusivity window. And there's a similar thing with the major chains in the U.S. with Roma. Like, I was talking to a publicist trying to set up regional screenings of Roma, and they have such a hard time with screenings of Netflix movies at major theater chains because even a screening at the theater chains, they're like, nope, Netflix pissed us off, so we don't want anything to do with it.
By the way, that's a good point. The theater chains are
we need them.
Like, they also need to like get it together and get it together with the 21st century, I think.
That's interesting.
That is the other side of the equation. It's like all the rules that they do, I get it. They keep them in profitability, but they're constantly complaining that they're at risk and that all these, you know, streaming services are putting them at risk and anything. Like, experiment a little, do something interesting and different.
Yeah.
Right? Wouldn't it be cool if more movies could be seen in theaters in more towns around the country?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see, like, AMC Stubs, I guess, is like kind of the next version of that after MoviePass cratered, finding ways to like make their business model not just about having something only for 6 months or something like that.
Right.
Like letting the windows shrink in that way.
Yeah. There's also like something cool about a little bit of delayed gratification in our world. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, I see Roma playing there. I should go see it or else I'll have to wait 3 weeks. That's okay.
Yeah.
We'll live. We'll survive.
Yeah. Who can imagine waiting 3 weeks for anything to just be delivered directly into your house and watch it? So are you going to go see Roma over Thanksgiving, Richard, with your family? Is that something you can imagine going and taking your parents to see?
I would, but we're not going to be in our usual spot, so I'm not sure. But that if I was looking at the lineup of movies out over Thanksgiving, I mean, obviously we'd go see Nutcracker in the Four Realms for the fourth time.
Yeah,
once for each realm. You know, and there's a part of me that also would be like, yeah, Green Book, you know, but no, Roma would definitely be my top pick.
I don't think I would go to The Favorite with my family. I'm just thinking of the movies that are going to be available around then. I'm looking forward to seeing The Favorite again. Not going to be a family movie.
They can see that on their own.
Exactly. Everyone can discover it for themselves.
The Favorite is exactly the kind of movie that I would put on a screener over the holidays and then
like, dare
20 minutes
to leave.
And be like, so I should take this off.
or my dad halfway, little less than halfway through Phantom Thread last year, turning to me and be like, so what's the point of this?
By the way, I had just had the opposite experience. I feel compelled to tell you that after sort of trash talking Phantom Thread all year last year, I watched it again with my wife and she loved it. And I much preferred it sitting next to her, watching her enjoy it that much than I had the first time. So
I feel like that's happening with a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson movies. The second viewing is when you're like, oh, okay, I get this.
And I think once you know where it's going, it's more interesting than when you're like, what the hell is happening with this movie?
That makes sense. Speaking of wives, did you talk about last week, sorry, I haven't listened yet, about this crazy Kenneth Branagh movie that just got dropped into the Oars season like at like the last minute?
No, I did not.
Yeah,
please.
There's this movie called All Is True. That is getting a little qualifying release at the very end of the year where Kenneth Branagh plays old Shakespeare and Judi Dench is his wife, is Anne Hathaway, not the actress.
Is Kenneth Branagh in like crazy age makeup? Because Shakespeare lived a long
time,
right? Yeah,
I mean, there's a photo that I just was tweeting about. But like, yeah, he's got like this, you know, this beard and this hairline and it's just like, So I don't know if he just like won the Oscars, but... something we should keep
Joanna,
an eye on.
Our best actor conversation just happened a week too early. There was so much information we had to deal with.
Yes, so. There's so many beautiful ruffs in this photo that I'm looking
at. Between that and Mary Queen of Scots, good time for ruffs.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Kenneth Branagh is like, he's in his weird hair experimental phase between Poirot and Shakespeare. He's like, just put whatever you want on my face. That's fine. Oh, it's by Ben Elton. That's so interesting. So Ben Elton did like, he's got a BBC show on right now called The Upstart Crow, which is about the life of Shakespeare. And then he's also very like famous and beloved in England for doing Blackadder. That's like a very famous thing that he did. And so like, oh, that's how Ben Elton, Kenneth Branagh, Shakespeare. I'm in. I'm sold.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
OK, Okay, let's share Cam's interview with Bing Liu, the director of Minding the Gap. It's nominated for many Critics' Choice Documentary Awards. He's in town for that ceremony this week. I just recently caught up on Minding the Gap, finally, after months of hearing people talk about it. It's on Hulu. It's incredibly easy to access. Joanna, I believe you also just recently watched it on Hulu.
I sure did.
We talked about Docs a while ago. I don't think we got into Minding the Gap in too much detail. This movie is really incredible. I was so stunned by it. I was like so glad I caught it. Joanna, did you feel the same way?
Yes, I thought it was incredible. And like, you know, we don't need to necessarily further bury a film that we've already buried plenty on this podcast. But it made another skateboarding film that we've talked about look like even more hollow. It's what that movie, I think, wants to be. But it is authentic and brilliant about these like three friends and the various directions that they went in. And the fact that like it's got that that boyhood cachet of like having footage from when they were very young versus, I don't know, what, mid to late 20s
yeah.
now.
So,
to see them age on camera is very powerful. It's very, very good.
Yeah, I know Cam was a big fan of the movie too and really wanted to talk to Bing Liu. So I was really excited to be able to put them together for this interview. So let's listen to it.
This is Cameron Austin Collins, film critic for Vanity Fair, and I'm here with Bing Liu, director of the great, great documentary, Minding the Gap, which is currently streaming on Hulu. If you haven't seen it, this is a very personal documentary about male adolescents, skate culture, cycles of abuse. But I just wanted to sit and pick Bing's brain a little bit to just get a sense from you of how you made such a personal, revealing, but also lively and alert and sensitive movie. So first of all, welcome. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, let's talk about making this movie. This is not, as I understand it, start off as you filming things to make a movie per se. You were filming your friends. Is that correct?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, in the sense that, you know, I filmed skateboarders. I filmed a community of chosen family who are my friends. Yeah, I did that since I was 14 or 15. There's a lot of sleight of hand. I didn't really meet Kier until I was in my 20s. You know, the other guy, Zach, I had maybe 5 minutes of footage from him. You know, I knew him very briefly. Kier and Zach are the two main protagonists of the film. Kier, you know, he's this teenager. He's like 17 or 18. I forget when we first really pick up from where his story starts. Really charismatic. He's the only African-American person in this white group of friends, this white group of chosen family skateboarders. Zach is, he's like 22 or 23 when we first start picking up with his story. He is about to become a father, but he's charismatic, sort of, you know, this floppy haired, just, person who's just the center of attention. And, he's very watchable. And, you know, it's about his journey being a father while not really being prepared for it.
Right. And how long have you known Zach?
I met him when I was 17 and he lived in like an exurb of Rockford. I saw him a few times at the skate park. I filmed him because he was really good, but, you know, we hung out maybe once or twice outside the skate park. And then I moved to Chicago when I was 19.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd been filming since you were 14 or 15. What is one filming? I know nothing about skate culture. So what I mean, from seeing a lot of movies about this recently, mid-90s, Skate Kitchen, et cetera, and also just growing up with movies like Slacker, my understanding is that there is often a videographer in the group of skaters. This is a very basic question. Sorry. I'm from New Jersey. I didn't have many skateboarders in my town, but the videographer, that was you, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's a common trope. There isn't always a videographer in a skate crew, but the things that make a skate community really thrive, you know, in the absence of any organization or any support is someone who's filming and making content within the group. And so, you know, in hindsight, I knew, like, you know, a lot of smaller towns and cities across America, there are skate crews. And, you know, there's a skate shop also is another way for a skate culture to survive in a town or city. But without a skate filmer, it's like the culture sort of dies. Like, after I left Rockford, there was, you know, there was sort of this absence of people who were filming skateboarding and making skate videos in a very serious way. And so I sort of belonged to a camp, I think, that was, you know, looked at skate videos as like a form of expression. The reason why I got a camera is actually I met these two kids from the Chicago suburbs, Matt and Gene. They spent years making videos and like they had favorite skate videos and they would show me, you know, what they liked and watched. And they used really sensitive music and they like would take time to get non-skateboarding shots for the videos. And so I was like, oh, that's interesting. I want to try doing what they're doing. And so I just started emulating skate videos that I liked. things that were boundary pushing.
Right. I mean, my impression from your film in particular is that skate videos have their own visual language, that there's a way in which in your movie you kind of use images of you guys skating to sort of, they add this momentum to the movie, and they also add this sort of emotional, I don't even know how to describe it. There's like this sense of freedom in the skating and of expression in the skating that is sort of a counterpoint to some of the more painful things that you guys are talking about. But I was really taken with the images of skating in themselves. They seemed very particular to that world.
Yeah, I mean, the images that are created in this world, it's very different from the way people film skateboarding. Traditionally, it's a fisheye. Everything's fisheye,
right.
You know.
I've noticed.
But what I was paying attention to, and this was something people had started doing in the 2000s, I think, more and more, especially a couple of filmers, Evan Hernandez and John Holland, who did a lot of the Transworld videos in that era, they would do things without a fisheye. They did long lens, combining zooms with rolling on a skateboard,
right.
You know, doing really, really interesting things that were like really, really designed and surgical. And so that's something that I latched on to as a teenager. And I think that helped me fall in love with, you know, making videos and editing, because, you know, the realization that, oh no, this isn't just, you know, random pointing and
right.
slathering music over things. You can be really surgical about it. In moving forward and making, like, filming more skateboarding, I was just kept trying to find ways to push it even further. For Mind in the Gap, I was doing something that no one else was doing, so it was a little weird, I think, because I was running. I was running with a rig behind people, in front of people, weaving in and out of traffic with them.
Is that dangerous at all? Weaving in and out of traffic. I don't know. I'm not a parent, but as soon as I hear that, I think, okay, wow.
Yes and no. I mean, you're not attached to the skateboard in the same way that you kind of are on a bicycle. I feel
right.
like I'm, I feel more, I wear a helmet when I bicycle, but I don't wear a helmet when I skateboard. Once you skateboard for over half your life, you know, which is true to me and the characters in Mind in the Gap, it's almost like you're more comfortable on a skateboard than you are walking.
Hmm.
Yeah.
There's extra layers to that in your movie as well. I would love to talk to you about just when it was that you decided to at some point start interviewing skaters about their home life, their emotional lives.
I mean, I was also emulating this as a teenager. Those Translo videos, you know, like one of them I really latched onto was called First Love. They had all the professional skateboarders who had parts in that video talk about when they first fell in love with skateboarding and why it's their first love. And it was very, you know, it wasn't tongue-in-cheek. They were really being earnest about it. So I did that as a teenager, you know, like get people to talk about skateboarding in a serious way. And then I sort of started making other things outside of skate videos and interviewing people. The first project where I really got deep into the subject of home life and trauma and identity and growing up was a project about two Vietnamese immigrants who both had happened to move to Chicago in 93. I made that while I was an undergrad. I was studying English, but any chance I could get to not write a paper and like do a video project instead, I'd swindle my professors into accepting that. So I did this project on these two Vietnamese immigrants, and you know, they both experienced a lot of trauma growing up, and it really hit close to home for me. And they talked about, you know, what it meant to try to find their identities now, you know, having come from such a fractured past. And that was really powerful and really emotional. For my next project, I sort of went back to the skateboarding community in a way. I was noticing how sometimes there was more lenses than skateboards at spots. You know, it's just like it was the proliferation of digital camera devices and YouTube and Facebook. And so I interviewed videographers and photographers, media makers in skateboarding to try to, you know, like deconstruct it. And a lot of people who filmed and took photographs of skateboarding talked about, you know, how it helped them get through really dark adolescences sometimes. And so, you know, that was sort of another pin in the board for me in terms of thinking about what I want to do next. That's sort of where Mind in the Gap was birthed from. It was like these two projects, you know, sort of trying to go even deeper in the skate community, you know, about issues of growing up and trauma. And so, yeah, I mean, the project started with me going around the country and having these really frank conversations with people. Some people who I'd like had loose connections with, other people I'd never met. And then a year and a half in, that's when I came back to Rockford, noticed this kid, Kier, and was like, hey, can we go interview? And then we talked about his father for an hour and a half.
Because Kier is one of the main characters in the movie. What made him stand out for you?
Mostly because he was... Charismatic is probably not the right word. He's full of energy. He's a ball of energy
yes.
that is just contagious. There's something about that. And he's really good at skateboarding. Really, really good. And he was just one black skateboarder in this group of white friends. And that's something we talked about that first time we sat down as well and became, you know, a thread that was very much part of his story in the film.
Right. And at what point did you and Zach, who you'd known personally for a longer time, decide to, because I do definitely want to talk about Zach's thread here, because I think there are things that he reveals in this documentary, that he allows you to reveal in this documentary, that are very sensitive. But at what point did you sort of get him in on the making of this project rather than sort of just filming skating?
After I moved to Chicago, it's like we sort of lost touch. I sort of had a situation where I had to move into a friend's place for a few months when I was in Chicago, and he happened to be sleeping on the couch for a few months. So
right.
it was a weird apartment situation. I was studying undergrad, and I would like just come home and like write papers, and I'd like walk past him chugging beers or whatever in the living room. And we just wouldn't really talk. And then when I came back to Rockford and started following Kier, we had had several shoots before. Kier was just happened to go to this sort of backyard pool party, and Zach happened to be there. And I was like, oh, hey, how's it? You know, it's like long time, man. And then I noticed his girlfriend was there and she was pregnant. You know, like her belly was really big. And I was like, oh, interesting. And so that's when I pulled him aside and did a, you know, just an on the fly interview with him. And I was like, okay. And from that, we had decided to, you know, he'd given me permission to go and follow them into the hospital on the day of their birth, which is what happened, which is a scene that didn't make it in the film, but it's a really powerful scene. So that's kind of how we connected and we started off filming.
Right. So for the people who haven't seen the movie, something that you reveal about both Zach and Kier and yourself are just these sort of histories of childhood abuse, of, you know, physical, emotional violence. And in the case of Zach, a sense of how that might pass from whoever abused him to him and from him to then his girlfriend, et cetera. But a question that sort of is on the minds, I think, of anyone who's seen the movie is, how do you get people comfortable in this way to reveal such trauma to the camera? Trauma is sort of the wrong word, because it's not as if the movie is indulging this like leering sense of violence in people's lives. But we are talking about, you know, parents, fathers in particular, abusing their sons. And the honesty of your movie, I think, is something, and people's comfort being honest in that way is something that I think is really striking, even as someone who's seen subjects like this in front of, in documentaries before. You're uniquely sensitive to these things. And I'm curious about the interactions you had with people, the conversations you had to have with people, to get them to be comfortable revealing themselves in this way.
It's a two-way street, right? Like, I mean, you know, they're going to give what they want to give. I think you have to just sort of know that they have control over whatever, you know, they want to talk about. But that's part of the reason why I started following Kier in particular, is because for him, that two-way street was wide open. First time we sat down and talked, and this is a person I've never, you know, had an interaction with, except for filming him getting into a fight when he was a little kid before I knew who he was. Me asking him about his relationship with his father, he just started, you know, I mean, it took a little bit of prodding, it took a lot of patience and sitting through awkward silences, but it's this sort of subtle chess game of unsaid asks and unsaid permission giving. I don't know. I mean, I think you just pay a lot of attention to cues that I think they're just trying to give, in terms of, it's painful to keep going, but maybe I want to keep talking about it. I don't know, it's something that's really hard to articulate, but I think it probably started when I was a child, and, you know, I had to be really hyper aware, because I felt like I was walking on eggshells in my household where I grew up in. So you look for any sort of minute cue to let you know, like, what's this person thinking? Am I going to get hurt? You know, that's something that I took with me as I became an adolescent, you know, and I started gaining friendships and interacting with more people and having those curious conversations that adolescents have. I really wanted to feel less alone. I really wanted to, you know, like just have the proof that other people do have vulnerabilities and, you know, they feel emotions and they're going through something. But in order to do that, I had to, you know, learn how to get people to open up. I, like, now I feel like I can't turn that off. It's just like that space where I love existing. Last night I went out with my friends here in New York that I haven't seen in a long time. And, you know, we talked about a lot of really personal things. And then as we were saying goodbye, I was asking my one friend, I was like, do you think I like just dig too deep? Do you think I'm like digging too deep all the time? Is that annoying? And he's like, well, no, because it's coming from a place of curiosity. He said sometimes people like really want to go to personal places, but it's really about them. It's really about like either proving a point that they might want to prove to themselves, or, you know, it's not about like exploring together. And I think for me, it's really about exploring and, you know, trying to answer these really deep questions that really just sort of nag at you and at night, they keep you up at night. I think we can do that better together. So all that to say, you know, I think that's sort of the philosophy behind, you know, how I was approaching Minding the Gap as well. And, you know, Kier was really open. And, you know, from that first conversation, it was like the whole film, his whole story would came out during that whole conversation. And it was like right. The rest of the time was sort of just watching him slowly grow up. It was very clear that he felt both love and anger and bitterness and guilt all wrapped up in one package about his father. And he had never processed it before. And, you know, and it seemed like he's willing to process it. And then, you know, in us going skating afterwards and me not judging him for it, you know, it sort of gave him more courage for the next conversation. For Zach, it was like, it was actually more of a, it was almost frustrating at times because, you know, Kier is giving so much emotional vulnerability, but Zach has this sort of defense mechanism of humor and charisma that he sometimes hides behind. You know, I'm saying that in hindsight even because after a while I just sort of gave up and I was like, you know, well, Zach just doesn't operate on this emotional level. You know, he's just a more logical, you know, left brain person. But one day as things were sort of getting dark in his storyline, he just decided for like a 2-hour sit-down interview just to really bare his soul in a way that was almost scary because it was so overwhelming and it, you know, it was so relatable, I think, in many ways.
Is it that you had reached a point in your relationship that he felt comfortable telling you or?
I think, again, this goes back to the two-way street. And I say this because, you know, at the beginning, he's very self-aware. He's, you know, in a weird way, he's self-aware about himself, but also the process of what we were doing, like the camera being there and like representation and everything. You know, many times he said, like, you're capturing a lot of like, you know, messed up stuff about my life being, but, right. You know, it is what it is and I accept it for what it is. I think within that is this validation of his story and, you know, at least feeling like he's getting, someone cares about him enough to just even be there, even for the bad stuff. In the one interview where he really sort of bares all, which is sort of the climax of his storyline on the emotional side, at the beginning of that interview, he said, hey, Bing, do you want the real shit or the fake shit? I was like, well, I've always wanted the real shit. You know what I mean?
What have you been giving me this whole time?
Yeah. And I didn't know that was like a secret. I thought that was just like a, you know, like a funny quip. But he gave me the real shit. And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, he's just like everybody else, you know, and has the same worries and concerns. And it's just been buried and repressed under many, many more layers than for Kier.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and speaking of it being a two-way street, a choice that you make in the documentary that I think is extremely powerful is that you gradually sort of reveal yourself as well, partially through an interview with your own mother about your own abusive experiences with your stepfather, but also just an interview with the skate shop owner who seems to have an instinct about you that he expresses to you on camera about your sort of home life, things that he sensed. In the making of this movie, where did your storyline come into it? Were you intending to reveal this much of yourself? Because I think even without your storyline, I always sense that there's a personal stake here for you. But I'm curious about when you decided to get in front of the camera.
Yeah, I didn't intend to do it at the beginning. I think the first time the thought sort of came up was in feedback screenings.
Hmm.
People, you know, asked like how I came to find this story. And, you know, I explained to them, well, I'm also from this, community. You know, I also skateboard. I went through similar things. And so I'm making this film to, you know, try to tell a story and make a narrative out of something that doesn't make sense. And they're like, well, have you thought about being in the film? And I just kept saying no and kept, you know, deflecting. But then, you know, this is a spoiler, but at one point in the film, we find out that one of the characters has been abusive. And so, you know, I had to sort of find a way to move forward. And there are many things that came out of that. You know, I took a 40-hour domestic violence course. I had to sort of go through this process of accepting, you know, this film might not ever come out. But one of the things that came out of that was, okay, I think there's a reason to explore my story now. And the storytelling mechanics sort of way where, you know, like, and it came out of the question of like, what gives the filmmaker the right to keep going here? You know, it's a very private matter. And I think, you know, thinking about the filmmaker as a character, if we understand the filmmaker, if we understand the filmmaker's reasons and backstory and sympathize for the filmmaker, then I think, you know, I don't think it justifies it because it's so subjective, but, you know, it helps, it would help the audience understand, you know,
right,
at least a reasoning for it.
Right. And not to spoil things, but a substantial part of this movie, and I think one of the many hearts of this movie is an interview that you have with your mom. Can you tell us about getting your mom into this? I could tell that was a difficult conversation. How did you convince her to want to appear on camera? This is someone that I would imagine never thought her son would be in her living room with camera equipment and lighting, asking her questions about her relationship to your stepfather.
Maybe I'm being dismissive, but I didn't see it as that big of a hurdle. You know, in many ways, it was like, I mean, I think maybe because people don't understand like how little I saw my mom and how threadbare our relationship was growing up. So I actually saw it as a chance to reconnect with her. I mean, it was a long interview, and I went into it thinking about, you know, like giving the filmmaker's character a backstory and like understanding the family dynamics and, you know, trying to get at like who the filmmaker's stepfather was through his family. So I thought of it more like expository. And in the cuts that I did before I started working with my co-editor, Josh Altman, it was a very expository scene, the ways that I would cut it. Once he came on and, you know, I gave him that scene, it was like almost his first pass is what you see in the movie. He saw the confrontation in it that I didn't. I mean, most of it was very much just like, okay, and then when did you move to this city in China? And like, when, why did we move to, you know, and this is the year that you went to college and you worked in this Chinese restaurant. Yeah. I mean, I had a blind spot to, you know, like me wanting answers and me like, you know, expressing to her that, you know, I have feelings of bitterness and anger and I don't know what to do with it, you know. That was the difficult part, was in, you know, seeing something that I couldn't.
Right. You know, something that you pull off in this documentary really amazingly to me is that you give a sense of Rockford and of its economic hardships and of those realities. And I think it's implied that that stuff is sort of an important sociological background. But something that you avoid doing is making it feel like poverty porn or making it feel sort of condescendingly dark. And I'm curious about how you found that balance. How I walk away with such a keen sense of what Rockford is like for you guys in a material sense, but I don't walk away thinking, well, gosh, like Rockford just seems like this awful place. I feel like I have a really naturalistic sense of the city, but not one that's despairing. And I think that's a really interesting balance that you strike. And I'm curious about how you did that.
Part of it was just like seeing I didn't start watching a lot of films, not just documentaries, but films in general until I was in my 20s. I didn't, you know, grow up being a cinephile or anything, but
probably better off for it, to be honest.
But like, you know, in watching documentaries, yeah, it was like trope. It was like, you know, driving through a bad part of a town and like, you know, like having voiceover talking about how there's crime and poverty and everything. And it doesn't feel human. It doesn't have, you know, this perspective that, you know, feels real, I guess,
right,
or feels true to the experience of people who actually live there. And I think, Rockford, where the story takes place, has a particular sensitive spot to, I guess, press shedding a negative light on the city. In 2013, Forbes magazine named it the most miserable city to live in America. The response was, you know, like the mayoral office put on this PR campaign that was like, Rockford's great. And then I think like even Michael Moore like showed up and like burned Forbes magazines, like like copies in
town. I'm
willing
to believe that.
But yeah, it was, you know, people were outraged. And I think growing up in throughout that era, that probably filtered into me. How do you honor the fact that, you know, there are these realities, these socioeconomic realities in the city, without blaming those realities on, you know, for the various things that people have to experience when they grow up? How do you both give volition, but also, you know, don't do that in a vacuum, right, to your characters? Yeah, it was just the process of trying to find it. At my first shoot, when I went out to try to like characterize Rockford, it was kind of generic. I was like going for portrait landscape. I was like, well, let me show, you know, like the sunset and the river with the skyline in the background. And it wasn't really saying anything. And then the next thing that I did as I came to Rockford, I just kept noticing these billboards paid for by like the ad council. It was, you know, billboards talking about the value of fatherhood, you know, painting statistics about, you know, fatherhood in the community. So I was like, well, why don't I just try filming that? When I was doing it, I was like, in my head, I was like, this is so cheesy. Like, this is, people are going to like laugh this off the screen. But I had it and we tried it. And then the next thing I thought of was, well, what if we film like spots where the characters had been, but now they're no longer there, and it's like a different time, and it's like a way to pass time, but also like show, you know, this like metaphorical way of showing, you know, the way that people interact with space. So I did that, but then I was like, wait a minute, these are all skate spots.
Right.
Like, what if we just get details on these skate spots, and it's like very, you know, we don't tell people what it is, and maybe slowly they'll realize that. And then the final thing, once domestic violence became a major thread, I was like, what if I just film these big old houses? You know, speaks to, you know, what a lot of, you know, Rust Belt cities have, which is big houses that are sort of falling apart, but also speaks towards, you know, what happens behind closed doors. And so a mix of those things with just like four or five like radio statistics was all we needed.
I think also just a huge impression that I have of Rockford comes from just the skating footage and just seeing you guys in the streets and the sense of freedom that you have there that would defy any sort of easy sense of the despair or poverty there. That there's, it does seem like you guys found family for yourselves. And I think that that is a good counterpoint to, you know, just images of poverty.
Right. I mean, people still have, I mean, I think this about any film that deals with a social issue, you know, like I crave an emotional like wholeness, like a palette of emotions that honors the whole color wheel. Sometimes you watch a film about, you know, an issue and it's like this one note of despair or stomach turning, you know, emotion. And I think the reality of growing up in Rockford, even dealing with, you know, a violent home life, you still have all the other emotions, you know, like right, at your disposal. You still experience hope and joy and friendship and love and heartbreak. And yeah, I think that's important to honor. And I think it's, you know, what's going to help us connect across all these lines in the modern day.
Yeah, for sure. So. Well, thank you for coming in to speak. And this is a great movie, Minding the Gap, currently streamable on Hulu. Please watch it. It's one of the most acclaimed movies of the year. I'm certainly one of the best. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
So that does it for this week's podcast. Thank you for listening. Find us on Apple Podcasts. Leave us a rating and review. Tell your friends. Tell your family what you're going to go see over Thanksgiving. And if you go see The Favorite and don't like it, don't blame us. You can find us at VanityFair.com. You can find us on Twitter at LittleGoldMen and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rye Laws.
And Mike.
Mike_Hogan.
And Joanna.
Joe wrote this.
This episode was edited and produced by Danielle Roth, and this week's award for the earliest Oscar season burnout goes to Mike Hogan.
Do the Oscars even matter?
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.